Bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order.
I just called Jim.
Friday, April 24th, we've got a pretty full agenda today, committee. I'm going to apologize in advance. There's a couple of bills coming up that we just got paperwork on that I may not have totally announced yesterday. Didn't know that we would have paperwork on them. They're relatively simple issues, and or at least I think they are. Having said that, but we are going to be doing a number of bills today. If you are here for House Bill 3145, that one will be carried over till Monday. Just so you know. And with that, I know we were waiting for a senator on a particular bill to start out with, but maybe not. Yes.
He's not coming. He's asked me to be his spokesperson.
Okay, that's easy. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2962. Or actually, excuse me, I cannot do that. I need to open up a work session on House Bill 2962. If I could have John Van Landingham come forward, please. Committee, this bill is a gut and stuff amendment to 2962. It won't have anything to do with the bill, the original bill, I don't believe. And so do we have, does the committee have the paperwork on that? I'll give them a chance to look at.
But is it, what's the dash?
Dash one.
2962-1. Should be in your packets, hopefully.
It is in our packet.
So if we could, if you would introduce yourself and walk us through the reason for this dash one amendment and what it does. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. This bill has nothing to do with manufactured home parks. Thank goodness. This is a constituent bill that Senator Posansky is doing for a lawyer in Eugene, and I'm working on it to make sure it doesn't mess something else up. So it's a gut and stuff of one of Chair Hovey's bills that he generously gave to Senator Posansky, because the bill that Senator Posansky started with had the wrong relating to clause once he figured out what it actually needed to do. It's fairly simple. It addresses this situation, a homeowner with a disability who employs a caregiver. Under federal law, the caregiver is not a tenant. The caregiver is an employee. The homeowner wants to be able to remove the caregiver when the relationship goes bad, and the homeowner wants to fire the caregiver. The caregiver has brought his domestic partner to live with them, so her occupancy is based on the caregiver's employment. There is no clear authority in Oregon law to fire that, to remove that person as a tenant or as an occupant, and to use an FED. The FED is the process in which we remove people from property, residential property, quickly. And there's a case that makes it difficult without clear authority to use an FED. You'd have to use a process called ejectment, which takes months as a regular lawsuit, whereas an FED takes weeks. So this bill is aimed at that, and what it does is address the situation in Chapter 91, which addresses non-residential Rental Tenant Act tenancies, and provides authority in the FED statutes to file an FED to remove the employee. That's all it does.
So can you explain, what was an FED again?
I'm sorry, FED is the eviction process. It's an old English term. It stands for forcible entry and detainer. So if you're a landlord or a property owner and you want to evict somebody and you want to be able to use the judicial process to do it, we typically discourage self-help evictions because they can lead to violence. We want people to use the eviction, the lawsuit process. You file a lawsuit in Lane County, for example. If you file it today, you get into court 8 days from today, which would have to be 10 days to get to the Monday. If you win, the sheriff will enforce your judgment by physically removing the person, the defendant. And that process takes another 4 or 5 days. So it's the fastest lawsuit in the world, or at least in Oregon, in terms of getting something done. So it's the way that you evict someone.
we call it an FED.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Residential FED statutes and procedure in Oregon is remarkably complicated. It does not surprise me whatsoever that there is this kind of murky situation in which there's also an employee-employer relationship. And this bill really does would bring some needed clarity to what could be a very shockingly and needlessly complicated piece of law.
Yeah. And for my, just to clear, because I probably wasn't paying attention to you when you started, which is not a good thing for me to admit. Just to clarify this, so this is a situation where you have a live-in caregiver essentially in somebody's home, and so they have a tenancy based on that, and they can be, I guess, their employment can be terminated, and then they have to leave, but the case is, what about that worker's spouse or...
So, Chair Holby, actually the employer in this case, the homeowner, would like to be able to use the FED process to be able to remove both the caregiver and the caregiver's partner, family.
Okay.
Because otherwise you're resorting to violence. I mean, self-help. In other words, you lock the person out. That's what a self-help eviction is, locking somebody out. And those often produce unpleasant exchanges. So we'd prefer that they use the court process, and the sheriff is used to doing that stuff. And the sheriff will actually, you have to pay fees, you have to go through the process, but you will actually have the sheriff come out, and you will change the locks, and the sheriff will make sure the person leaves.
Yeah, I was just trying to make sure I understood that it applied to both the caregiver and the caregiver's family or whoever happens to be living with.
Chair, that's correct. That's okay. The purpose here. And my good job is trying to keep this out of Chapter 9 of the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, because this is not a landlord-tenant relationship, which is how I got involved in the first place, is making that clear.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, John, are we trying to solve the situation of the employee or just the employee's family, or both?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, both.
So, both of them have a problem with both, right?
Correct.
Okay, follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
I just want to be clear. My reading, you have said a couple of times that this has to do with somebody providing in-home care. But my reading of this is that it wouldn't necessarily be that narrow, that it would actually pertain to anybody who was an employee for any reason and was living in the person's residence. So it's a little bit broader than just that. I just want to make sure I'm reading the bill correctly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, that's correct. The most common instance is going to be a caregiver, and that was the instance that the constituent raised with Senator Prozanski. But it could be other employees. It's somebody whose occupancy is a result of being an employee. There aren't that many of those situations, but there are others than caregiver.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Help me understand if the way this is written, it applies only to an employee who's living in the actual home of the employer, or simply an employee who lives in a residence owned by the employer, which might not necessarily be the employer's home.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, the latter is the instance that the alternative description you gave would be akin, or most commonly, an apartment manager. So there is something in Chapter 9, the Residential Landlord-Tenant Act, which I wrote you all passed some time ago, which says that landlords can evict an employee whose occupancy of a dwelling unit in a rental project is premised on the employment. But it's the same process, 24-hour written notice and an FED. In both cases, that's an improvement to being locked out if you're the employee. But this one is aimed at non-rental property, the one in this bill, whereas the other example would be rental property.
One more follow-up?
Or am I not missing your question?
Follow-up, Representative Wingard.
Let me make sure that I understand this. So if I were to own a home in Salem that I rent out to one of my legislative assistants, so they're my employee and I'm renting to them, are we affecting that in this bill?
or not? I mean, in other words, do they have a, because they're my employee, I understand that part of it, but do they also have a landlord-tenant relationship with me, or because they're my employee, they are outside the scope of the landlord-tenant law and are now subject to this much narrower set of procedures?
Are you a lawyer?
Representative Chair Holby.
Now, did I insult him?
I was just going to come with him.
The answer would be yes.
Did I insult him?
Yeah.
No, but we are 20 minutes.
I'm not sure. So you're asking a question that I need to think about. This bill has to have amendments.
Representative Barton.
Thank you. If I may, although you wrote the bill, I concede. However, I believe the answer to Representative Williams' question regarding the LA and the home would be no. This bill would not apply to that unless, for whatever reason, your LA is commonly worked in and about, like, the home. We'll notice line 6 and 7 in particular is conditional upon employment in and about the premises.
Thank you.
In that case, because their employment is not in and about the premises, presumably they're employed in the capital, this bill would not apply to them, as I believe.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I appreciate the indulgence. I'm sorry if I'm holding up the process, but this is almost like a public hearing on a brand new bill. I think
it actually is
like a public hearing on this. So I appreciate taking the time to help me understand what it is I'm about to vote yes or no on.
So I should note that there are some amendments, but we, Senator Brzezinski, would like to do those on the Senate side, and I'm in agreement to working with him on that. So I'm fine with the bill moving as it is.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? I'd entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2962.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2962. Discussion? Not seeing any. Is there an objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendment? Not seeing Dash 1 amendments are adopted. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2962. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 3151. Victoria, will you give us a brief summary of 3151?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3151 modifies requirements transfer of motor vehicle must meet for liability protection. You should have a Dash 1 amendment in front of you.
And Megan Perry. Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure.
Does everybody have that found the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3151?
Yep. Anything else, anyone?
Or do I?
I do.
Okay.
I don't know.
Because they just pulled all these off my email.
I don't seem to have it either. So I'm going
to... Oh, I've got it in my file.
It's in my file.
Yeah.
Oh, it's in your file?
Yeah.
Well, now I lost my committee administrator. So, I'm going along pretty well here. So,
you want mine?
No.
I have an extra copy.
Megan, why don't you go ahead and get started?
Okay. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Megan Perry. I'm policy aide for Representative Chris Harker. He was here a couple of weeks ago with a constituent regarding House Bill 3151, regarding a title transfer issue where the his constituent had been called into court 6 years after selling a vehicle because of he had filled out the paperwork. Somehow the paperwork got lost in somewhere along the line, and then the person who he had sold the vehicle to never turned in their portion of the title, and so therefore he was the last registered owner and was held liable in court. And so our first attempt at solving this problem, we had it here, and members of the committee were very helpful in some of their suggestions in consultation with Representative Riley and DOT as well as DMV. It was suggested that we do a receipt, that the easiest way to solve this problem, at least for this in this time period, is to provide a receipt when you turn in a title, when you go to the DMV to notify them of your selling of a vehicle. So that is the Dash 1 amendment before you.
Thank you. I recall it now. Committee, I apologize. We did hear this bill once before, and I think they did come back with the amendment that we discussed previously. Okay. Does anybody have any questions for Megan? Not seeing any, but I appreciate your coming forward and just laying it out for us and refreshing our memory on that. Thank you.
Of course.
I don't see anybody else signed up for 3151. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3151 and open up a work session on House Bill 3151.
Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3151.
Representative Riley moves Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3151. Any discussion? Any objection to adopting the Dash 1 amendments? Not seeing any, they are adopted.
We have the fiscal.
And we have a fiscal statement that indicates no revenue and minimal fiscal expenditure impact.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Riley.
I move House Bill 3151 to restore the due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3151 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Not seeing any. Cindy, will you give us a roll call vote, please?
Martin?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3151, having received required votes, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll close, and I suppose we'll have Representative Harker carry this bill on the floor. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3151. I'd like to open a work session on House Bill 2383. Representative Nathanson. Good afternoon. I'd like to identify yourself for the record and tell us about what we're doing with this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Mathenson, representative from District 13. I'm not going to take your time talking to you about the bill because I know how pressed you are for time. I have offered an amendment, a Dash 2 amendment, which adds an effective date in the future. It would make it effective January 1st, 2012. So if I may, I'd like to tell you the intent of the amendment.
Okay.
If there is a better way to accomplish this objective, and there likely is, this should provide ample time for parties to get together and discuss what might be a better way to implement the objective of enabling the residents of manufactured home parks to purchase their parks when possible. So providing a date this far in the future should give ample time for the parties to discuss it and propose legislation that could be drafted for the next session.
Thank you. Questions? Not
seeing any questions at this time, do we have anybody else signed up on this? So, Representative Nathanson, this bill is essentially a 14-day first right of refusal.
That's right.
And it takes effect January 1st, 2012.
With an amendment, yes.
With the Dash 2 amendment. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, without the amendment, it would take effect as it was originally planned, as bills, you know, take effect.
Right, right. So you, so this is a topic that's under discussion, and this bill basically will put this in place in statute and make sure that if there's objection to this, that it gets dealt with.
Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're exactly right.
Thank you.
Lots of knobs in the back.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, thank you for bringing this. I like the amendment. I think it's a pretty good idea to accomplish what you would like to do. If, God forbid, the parties who have a history of working harmoniously and productively together are unable to come up with something, I would love to actually revisit this, because 14 days is just, it would be almost impossible for even an individual to come to essentially finance a fairly complex real estate acquisition, and never mind an association which has its own complexities. And we'd have to, I think, in the next legislative session, if the parties are unable to come up with something, I think we'll have to extend that somewhat to actually have this work as I think we intended to.
So I'd like to, if there's no other questions for Representative Nathanson, I don't know if she wants to stay or head off to other duties. But I would like to have John Van Landingham and John Brennan come up briefly as well. They were on my sign-up sheets somewhere. Thank you, gentlemen. I just want to get your take on the bill on the record and see where we're going to go.
Somebody go first.
You go first.
Me. We'll flip a coin. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Brenneman. I represent Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon, have since 1992. It's a trade association of landlords, people who own parks, rent spaces, and we have about 500 members. We represent about half the parks in the state. A few sessions ago, I think this is our sixth session, I might be wrong, that a number of us sat down and started negotiating and trading issues and landlord-tenant matters and manufactured home parks, and it actually been very successful. We testified in opposition, our group did, when this bill was heard earlier. We don't have a problem in negotiating this issue. We still object to the implementation date and putting our feet to the fire, so to speak, to do it. John Van Landingham and I talked as recently as last week, and I asked him if he was okay with the legislature setting his agenda, because our deal is, and our rule is, we get to trade one issue for residents for one issue for landlords. And he does want to talk, or the residents do want to talk about this issue, and that's fine. We don't have a problem sitting at the table and coming up with a way this could be implemented. There is already some language in statutes that provide for a procedure when a park comes for sale, that a resident association be formed and that the landlord deal in good faith with the residents. It's to a park owner's distinct advantage to sell to residents. The state of Oregon forgives capital gains taxes on a sale to residents. If you had that too at the federal level, I don't think you'd ever find a park being sold to anybody but a resident organization. We would just encourage the committee to set the bill aside. Let's work on the issue. We've got a good record for a number of sessions and sitting at the table. There are other members of the coalition that are in the room, and I don't know or presume to know what others are going to say about it. I'm just presenting The view of one member of the Landlord-Tenant Coalition that likes to keep working on issues and bring solutions to you. Thank you.
John Van Landingham, Lane County Legal Aid. I agree.
Agree with Mr. Brenneman.
Okay. Appreciate
that. Questions from the committee?
Just to say, Mr. Chair, this has been an ongoing, one of the better examples of, you know, communicating and working your differences out and try to make both of you winners. And that saves us a lot of problems. I wish more people did it. They wouldn't have this problem pills in front of us.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, might I add to that comment to the chair and the committee members? I served in the legislature, as many of you know. I was here in 85 through 91, and it used to be a war. Legislators would have residents walking the halls. It was high intensity, and nothing ever got done to the benefit of either side until 91. There was a coalition that formed that really rewrote the law, and then it was back kind of to fighting again until six sessions ago when we restarted the process of sitting in the room and working things out.
Thank you. I appreciate the comments. I should ask, are there any other questions for the committee, from the committee? I'm going to recess for a few minutes here.
House 3164.
I'm not reconvening.
We are not.
Oh, that's the only.
bring the Consumer Protection Committee back to order, and I will close the work session on...
We're going to close the work session?
On House Bill 2383. So, up next, I want to do... I would like the House... consider 2189. I'm open a work session, House Bill 2189. Victoria, will you preview where we're at?
I would be delighted. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2189 authorizes Oregon's participation in the nationwide mortgage licensing system and registry, NMLSR, under the Department of Consumer and Business Services, requires DCBS to adopt rules necessary to conform to the requirements of the Federal Housing and Economic Recovery Act of 2008, requires loan originators to be licensed through NMLSR, requires mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, and persons who use loan originators to maintain bond or letter of credit and to retain records of loan originators through NMLSR, sets educational and testing requirements for loan originators and requires submission of information for criminal records check, specifies grounds for denial, suspension, or revocation of license of mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, or loan originators, and is effective on passage. We are looking at the Dash 7 amendments, for which you should have a fiscal statement and a notice of no revenue impact.
There, first up, I'd like to have David Tatman, please. Now we're open to a work session.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. This is David Tatman for the record, the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And before you, you have the Dash 7 amendments to 2189. The Dash 7 amendments were built off of the Dash 2 amendments that we discussed the last time I was before you. So rather than reiterate at great length what those cover, I just want to very briefly identify what the Dash 7s cover. At the close of the hearing of on the Dash 2s, we were asked if we could revise some language regarding the role of realtors within the coverage of this bill. We've addressed that. There are modifications in the Dash 7s, and the Real Estate Association of Real Estate Brokers has indicated to us that they find that acceptable. Per discussions with members of the committee, we were asked to modify the language in Section 4 that talks about financial responsibility. We were asked to take out issues regarding moral fitness and alike. Dash 7s address that also. We've had discussions at great length about the size of the penalties involved. The Dash 7s were an attempt to try and strike a middle ground. Our mortgage lender laws allow for a $5,000 penalty per violation and a $20,000 cap for ongoing violations. We think it's fair to treat those that violate 2189 in the same way. And so the Dash 7s have reduced that $25,000 penalty down to a $5,000 penalty per violation. We've had great discussions about the possibility of criminal prosecution for violations of 2189, and we have taken great pains to try and get this right. We've adjusted this three times, and our latest version is found in Section 4 on page 14, and we specify very specific provisions within the Act that could be a basis for criminal prosecution, plus a culpable mental state of a violation has to be done knowingly. So we think we've addressed the concerns.
Excuse me, did you mean Section 8?
I'm sorry, I meant Section 4. Did I say 14?
You said page 14.
Page 14.
14. Subsection 4, Section 8.
That's right. I'm sorry. You're right. Section 8, subsection 4.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have also taken out references to specific federal laws with respect to banking activity involving residential mortgage loans and credit union activities. Those were sections 33 and 34. We have a companion bill in 2199, which we'll address later on, asking that we clarify, per our Attorney General's Office's opinion, that a violation of any state law or federal law would be a basis for us to act. The Oregon Bankers Association and the Credit Union Association of Oregon have both expressed acceptance of that. And so we've made those, we have removed those. At the time of the last hearing, Mr. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association, asked to have similar treatment for the consumer finance lenders. We did not find that there was a comparable language within the bill to allow us to do that. Therefore, if we want to change the way we look at consumer finance lending practices, we think that's something that we want to take a look at throughout the course of the interim and possibly come back and do a more omnibus approach to consumer finance lending overall. But we did not have the ability to do just that within the current language of Chapter 725. So those are the changes that the Dash 7s make on top of the Dash 2s. And with that, I'm happy to take questions or sit back and wait for other questions.
Thank you. Any brief questions, Representative Wingard?
Always dangerous, I know. Sir, there was, I believe Mr. Cosgrove, or maybe it was somebody else, had discussed some concerns about private right of action against employees rather than the company themselves. Is that this bill? Am I on the right
chair? Question? Representative Wingard, that's
that
right.
Been addressed?
But the private right of action is only to the company. The private right of action is only to the employers, not to the employees.
So we made that change then?
That we made that change in the Dash 2s.
Can you tell me which section that is? Sorry, Mr. Chair.
If you give me a moment.
Mr. Chair, is Mr. Cosgrove going to testify on this or give us any feedback on?
If he may, yeah. All right. We're in work session. Mr. Cosgrove, would you care to come forward?
Sorry to do that to you, Mr. Cosgrove.
That's fine. I'll just keep looking.
Mr. Cosgrove may know off the top of his head, perhaps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oscar, representing Oregon Financial Service Association. Was there a particular question you wanted me to address?
Well, you'd had questions about a private right of action against individual employees. You expressed some concern about that. I'm just wondering if we've moved anywhere on the dial on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winger, we had concerns in the Dash 1s about private right of action against employees and in the Dash 2s about a new private right of action against the companies, both of which were concerned. It's relatively unprecedented to have a private right of action against a lender for a violation of licensing statutes. Banks don't have that. Credit unions don't have that. The Dash 7 still have the private right of action against the companies. It's in Section 41 to 43, I don't have the section number, is the private right of action against the companies. And the handout I just gave to staff to pass out to you explains our reason for our concern about that, especially for our smaller family-owned companies.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
So, to both of you gentlemen, is this a private action against just the amount of the bond or beyond that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winger, it is for the amount of the actual damages suffered by the consumer, which is the standard of ascertainable loss, a relatively low standard, plus attorney's fees. It is not limited to the amount of the bond. The bond is relatively large. It's been moved from $25,000 to $50,000, but in litigation, I think most of you who have had the unpleasant fact of being in litigation know that $50,000 is not an unusual amount of attorney's fees to find in a case, at least to the extent it goes to trial.
Just one more question.
Representative Winger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me understand again why we would treat this group differently than the others on this issue. And what I realize, I think you suggested we may need to keep working on this in the interim. Where do you think, where are we going on this, and why does there have to be some, why do they have to be treated differently than credit unions and others?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wingard, as we discussed, this is really a shift in the way we look at loan origination. The people that Mr. Cosgrove's, the people that he represents, these employees are now having to get licensed as loan originators. They're already subject to, they haven't been subject to regulation in the past. Our loan originators, our mortgage lenders, those who are making residential mortgage loans, and that's all that this would provide for. This is not allowing for lawsuits in other capacities. It's only for the mortgage loans, so the home equity loans and first and seconds. Those lawsuits are already existing for our mortgage lenders. We think that these are doing the same type of activity. We think they should be held to the same level of the same standards. And that's what we've tried to do, is be even across all playing fields, if you will, between loan originators of mortgage lenders, loan originators of manufactured structured dealers, mortgage loan originators of consumer finance lenders. So we don't think we're treating them differently than banks and credit unions. We think we're treating them the same as other mortgage lenders. And that's what Congress has said. And so we are implementing that as Oregon has developed a body of law for how to handle loan originations in residential mortgage lending.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question, I suppose, for either one of you. I'm now thinking about this, and I wonder if this really is indeed a new cause of action. For example, let's pretend a credit union or a bank or, frankly, any business issued, and I'm reading the statute now. Makes an untrue statement of a material fact, which then, upon the reliance, caused damages, which wouldn't that be a breach of duty? Wouldn't that be an ordinary negligence claim that could be first of all, as I stated previously, I think this will be an extraordinarily rare fact pattern that this cause of action instead in statute is actually invoked in practice. But is this statute even necessary for a person to state a claim under tort law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barton, from our perspective, no. And as I stated in the handout, we are subject to claims already, as everyone is, for breach of contract and for negligence and for fraud and for violation of a whole raft of consumer protection statutes. For us and for mortgage brokers, the state has proposed another cause of action, and we believe it is unnecessary. It covers additional activities that wouldn't normally be able to be pursued by a consumer, such as licensing violations. And you and I have had the conversation of whether that kind of claim would be rare or common, and people could differ on that. But that kind of a licensing violation has traditionally, with respect to lenders, been the purview of the department to issue cease and desist or fines or penalties, not a private lawsuit. So that's the concern.
I see.
And it is not a lawsuit that is available against credit unions or banks. It's just available against us, some mortgage brokers.
Any other questions for these folks? Thank you very much. I'm going to call a recess at this time for just a few minutes. Thank you.
I'd like to check with them.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good, that's great.
We're going to reconvene the House Committee on Consumer Protection. We're currently talking about House Bill 2189, the Dash 7 amendments, and they got away from me before I got done. So, Mr. Tatum, could you come back up? So I just wanted to find out on this private right of action that we were just discussing. You had mentioned that what Congress has done, and so in the Federal SAFE Act, is there a private right of action at all mentioned in that, or do they have that type of enforcement in that model?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is no such provision in the SAFE Act itself. That this is a strictly a regulatory bill, if you will. This is handed down to the states to then implement. And as I say, we are incorporating it into the state of Oregon's model for mortgage lending. And since 1993, there's been a private right of action against mortgage lenders. And as Representative Barton and others have mentioned, it's relatively rare, and you've got to show an ascertainable loss. So the suggestion that people will be suing for somebody not being licensed, there's no causation between not being licensed and the loss. So I think that is not the concern that it may be being represented to be. And so I'll defer to the committee, obviously, to make that decision. That's a policy decision for the committee.
Okay, so you see this as treating the industry all the same, essentially.
Correct.
From what I'm hearing. All right, thank you. Tim Martinez, did he want to speak to this, or... oh, he left the room. Okay. And? 1, 2, 3, 4.
Do you want me to go...
I'm going to stand at recess for a minute until I get some members back in here.
An additional one to move?
First, reconvene the House Committee on Consumer Protection, and we're currently in work session on House Bill 2189. I'm going to close that work session to reopen it in a few minutes. So I'm closing 2189, open a work session on House Bill 2199. And Mr. Tatman. Victoria, will you give us a brief summary of House Bill 2199?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2199 authorizes Department of Consumer and Business Services to oversee financial holding companies and bank holding companies, eliminates the 30-day posting requirement for consumer finance license applications, removes the requirement that DCBS set fees for banks and trusts, credit unions, and consumer finance in a single annual rulemaking process, repeals regulations governing savings associations which no longer apply to institutions operating in Oregon, authorizes DCBS to share information with federal agencies that regulate financial institutions, moves date on which DCBS issues calculated discount rate from the first business day of each calendar year to the second Friday in December.
Thank you.
And Mr. Tabman, could you tell us a little bit about the amendments that we're looking at in this bill now?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, David Tabman with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I believe what you have before you are the 2199-3 and 2199-4. Are we all on that page?
Yes.
Sort of.
That's where we're at.
Okay, thank you. As the committee probably recalls, the 2199 was an omnibus bill to address a number of financial service issues, and as Ms. Cox has listed the general gist of them. The 2199-3 was an amendment proposed by the Oregon Bankers Association to eliminate provisions regarding bank holding companies, and the 2199-4 are the amendments that I referenced just previously while talking about 2189 that clarifies that the director's authority over banks and credit unions, ability to take enforcement action, includes the authority to take action for violation of any law of this state or of the United States. And that was the agreement that we've reached with the Credit Union Association and with the Oregon Bankers Association. So those two amendments have, as far as I know, the support of our agency as well as those two trade associations.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Mr. Martinez, would you like to testify? No? Seems to be fine. I'd entertain a motion on the Dash 3 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Dash 4, sir?
I believe we're adopting both the Dash 3 and the Dash 4.
Chair, can we do both at once?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
hang on a second. Stand in recess for just about 2 minutes. House Committee on Consumer Protection, and we're in work session on House Bill 2199. Committee, it's been a while since we heard this bill. I don't know when we last heard it, quite frankly. It seems like
17th.
A little while ago. So we do have another set of amendments that we previously discussed, the Dash 1s, and I overlooked those because we hadn't adopted them yet. So, Mr. Tabman, can you just refresh our memory on the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, for the record, David Tabman. And the Dash 1s had a number of changes. As I said, most of the bill was just to clean matters up, and one of the attempts was to meet the Oregon Financial Services Association's concern about the index that we would be using as the alternative form of calculating the annual rate for capping consumer finance lending. That was one of the amendments in the Dash 1, probably the most significant one from their perspective. And so at the time we discussed the Dash 1s, I don't believe there was any opposition with the exception of the language that has been removed through the Dash 3s. So I would request the committee to consider the Dash 1s, the Dash 3s, and the Dash 4s.
Thank you for that clarification. So, Representative Riley, could I have a motion on the Dash 1?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2199.
Senator Riley moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2199. Any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 1s are adopted. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2199.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2199. Any discussion?
Any objection? Seeing none, they are so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four amendments to House Bill 2199.
Representative Riley moves the dash four amendments to House Bill 2199. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, they are so adopted. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair.
Never mind. That, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2199.
We have them on one, but not three and four.
Okay. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2189. And Representative Riley, could I have a motion on the dash 7 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I move dash 7 amendments to House Bill 2189.
Representative Riley moves the dash 7 amendment to House Bill 2189. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Matthews.
Yeah, and I apologize. I had to testify at the Senate for Senate President Courtney had asked me to be down there. I'm just kind of curious, and I know a lot of folks have worked on this bill. Does it come down to one key issue that we're hung up on in terms of getting people on board with the bill? Is it the private right of action? Is that what we ended up with? Or could somebody just brief me up to speed where we're at?
Representative Matthews, that was the discussion and I guess a point that there wasn't consensus on. I think we heard from Mr. Cosgrove that felt that we didn't need to have that in the bill, and the agency feeling like they have that private right of action exists against other mortgage lenders and wanted to have that be consistent with loan originators, and I don't know if anybody else would like to add their take on that, but that's generally the sense that we heard from the committee. I'm comfortable moving the bill forward as is, and that's the motion on the dash 7 amendments to adopt them.
Okay, and I recognize there's been a great deal of work by many members on the committee, and Mr. Tapman and Mr. Cosgrove as well, so I recognize that. Thank you.
So, is there objection to the Dash 7 amendments? Seeing none, Dash 7 amendments are adopted to House Bill 2189. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2189 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended with a subsequent referral by prior reference to Ways and Means. Any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got to oppose the bill. I appreciate the discussion, but I'm disappointed that we can't step away from the private right of action issue. I understand the need to regulate and to do something about this issue in a broader sense in Oregon, but I wish we could have come to a compromise. I'm also disappointed that our one-size-fits-all seems to me isn't working. I wish that we could have accommodated the manufactured home folks. But there we are. Thank you for allowing me to dissent.
Thank you. Further comments, discussion? Representative Gilliam, I appreciate your comments, and I know that it's difficult to do everything in the bill. I'm confident that many issues will be addressed in rule, and of course there is the other side of the building to talk about the manufactured housing piece of it, but very difficult to get everything into this. This is a extremely important bill, as you heard from the Association of Mortgage Professionals, I believe, Mr. Hendrickson, if I remember correctly, speaking very highly of this bill and how important this is, and I think this is an extremely important bill to go forward. I'm confident that the issues in this bill
will not result in any unfair or advantage to one industry over the other. But I don't have a crystal ball, just as nobody does. But I think there's been a great deal of compromise throughout this process on this bill. A great deal of input from industry and from this committee and from stakeholders, and this bill's been worked for well over a year now, and I think it's a fine product. There may be a couple more tweaks left to do on the other side, perhaps. The Senate will take another look at these issues, and so we'll have another set of eyes on it for sure, but I appreciate your dissenting vote.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments, and I am not complaining about fully vetting and airing it. We've put some time into it. I guess on the positive side, I did enjoy hearing a word during the discussion that I'd never heard before. It was from a colleague of mine on this dais. The word is Solomonic. By trying to think of something positive I could say.
Oh, yeah.
I appreciate hearing that.
That one caught me by surprise, too. Thank you. Representative Martin, did you have a... Yeah, I believe he was referring to you.
She's not likely one of my...
Well, when people talk about Solomonic, they often are referring to me, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. So with that, Representative Krieger, do you need to be...
2189. Okay, I've got it.
There was still an outstanding issue on the private right of action involved in this bill on the -7 amendments, which we've already adopted. And Representative Gilliam has expressed his dissent on the bill.
I think I would probably do the same as the advice of...
Maybe you should get your advice from the chair. So, with that...
Yes, I do remember where we were.
That, Cindy, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Krieger?
No.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Wingert?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2189, having received required votes, is passed on to Ways and Means. That, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2189. Open a we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2191. Victoria, as soon as you find the right packet, since you didn't get my order in advance.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2191 requires persons who provide debt management service to register with Department of Consumer and Business Services unless exempt, authorizes DCBS to require registrants to maintain corporate surety bond or irrevocable letter of credit, allows grievant to take action against registrant's bond or letter of credit, specifies contents of contracts for debt management services, and requires registrants to provide report on funds held in trust account effective on passage, and we reviewed the -1 amendments yesterday.
Thank you. Committee, we had a pretty extensive public hearing on this bill last night, and the chair is comfortable with moving this bill forward with the -1 amendments. I know there was not a consensus on the fee agreement from the organization, the USOBA organization, I believe, and the task organization. I think we got to a place where the credit counselors and the debt management companies were okay with the bill, and this bill was also
a result of a lot of conversation, a lot of back and forth on issues around debt settlement and debt management for consumers. And so I'm prepared to move the bill. Representative Krieger.
I think there's a lot of merit, Mr. Chair, in what you're wanting to do, but it seemed that the services that were provided by certain types of people went way beyond what I understood that they ever did, the counseling and meeting with them a couple times a week or a month. And I think the fee isn't adequate for that type of service, but it doesn't seem like there's a way of dividing that out or to understand, you know, some way that certain types of fees for certain parts that probably shouldn't be even included, because it goes beyond debt settlement. It's financial counseling that you may go get somewhere else for a lot more of a cost, have nothing to do with debt settlement, just it would cost you a lot of money. So I that's where my hang up was. I thought that's where we went astray.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I looked at this business model for quite some time, and my concern was I kept getting examples of cases where in fact there was no service being provided and extremely large monthly fees being charged by the very companies that said they were making two calls a week to creditors and everything else. And so I have evidence that that's not always the case. And so, you know, you have to find a balance somewhere. And I think the Debt Management Association's fee structure was compatible with this fee structure. And I tried to structure the debt settlement fee structure so that when they actually did provide the value to the consumer, by reducing their debt and getting them to a debt settlement, essentially, that they would be able to get a percentage on the amount that they say or reduce the debt by. And I thought that you know, in my estimation, that would allow you know, ethical business to stay in business. It's a little bit different than the model that they're under right now, but that's.
Mr. Chair, did they? Was the number somewhere between 4 and 10 is what they expected this would affect?
Of debt settlement companies?
They would be the new regulated.
Right, I believe it was.
Everybody else already kind of is.
Yes, I believe. I don't know if Mr. Tapman would want to come forward and comment on this. He's probably worn out by now, but I don't know why all these bills got done at the same time, but
I appreciate the fact that you tried to coordinate it for us. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee and Representative Krieger, David Tapman again for the record. What we understood and what we heard, in fact, from the members of the trade association themselves, that four entities have gotten licensed, and I guess it's up to seven now in Colorado. I can't tell you why so few choose to get licensed, even though they said, we heard yesterday, that the law in Colorado was more favorable to their business model. I'm not sure a lot of them really want to get licensed. I think they may like operating in the shadows, but nonetheless, yes, we're estimating between 4 and certainly less than 20 getting licensed with us. As you pointed out, Representative Krieger, we already have some 77 people that have a license with us under the broad debt management umbrella.
So, and certainly, you know, there's already fees in place, Mr. Krieger, that many organizations already charge for setup and for monthly fees. And so in essence, the fee structure of a few of the debt settlement companies were higher, and we're bringing that fee structure to a lower amount and providing them a way to get fees at the tail end when they provide that value to the consumer.
Yeah.
Is that an accurate description of?
Mr. Chair, absolutely accurate. The model we use for debt consolidation agencies, people that you heard from Jan Ameling yesterday, and she gave us their model, and they charge that fee for education, and they charge a fee for initiating a file, and there's a maintenance fee, if you will. And we thought that was a pretty good model. And then, as the chair pointed out, there's a back end. If you provide services that are successful, then you get paid for that.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
A question for Representative Barton. Administrator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I regret that I was unable to attend last night's hearing. Could you explain to me, for example, the difference between the dash 1 and dash 2, which I have in front of me, both kind of too thick for me to skim?
Well, Mr. Tatton probably better to do that. I'd take a stab at it. I think the main difference is in the dash 2 amendment, they're allowed to charge a 15% fee with no cap. And the Dash 1 amendment has a $65 per month cap on the size of the fee that they can charge for this service. And frankly, I had asked these organizations several times what kind of services they were providing on a monthly basis, that because essentially they build up an account. And then when that account gets large enough, they negotiate the debt down and pay off the debt. And I didn't get a good answer on you know, why they needed to have you know, very high rate on a monthly basis. And in fact, we had cases, and a constituent of mine that I'm very familiar with, who was making $10 an hour, a single mother, and they were taking $221 and sometimes as high as $310 out of her bank account every month, and provided no services for her, and she ended up telling her not to contact her creditors, and her wages ended up being garnished in the middle of all this. And we actually had testimony from other people who had the same thing happen with these companies that were you know, testifying on this, on the fee structure without having a cap. And so I'm just not compelled to you know, allow that kind of scenario to go on. I think frankly they can make good money if they provide the service that they advertise that they're doing for these consumers, if they do reduce their debt. So that's essentially probably a longer definition you wanted. Mr. Tatton, you care to comment on Representative Barton's question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, there is no difference between the one and the two, with the exception of the fee, and the only change was a reversion back to the language that's already in Chapter, I believe, 629 for debt consolidation agencies. Speaking candidly, although it wasn't our amendment, we understand from talking to the members of the task group that the amendment that they had sought in the Dash 2s wasn't properly done, and this would only allow for that 15% without a $65 cap for debt consolidation agencies, which is not their business model, so it doesn't achieve anything. And so, in essence, the Dash 1s and the Dash 2 are virtually identical.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Can you actually, again, I don't mean to make you scramble. Does anyone here know what section contains the key difference?
I'm happy to.
Sorry to do this, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I wasn't here last night. Sorry.
You better have a good excuse for not being here last night.
Yeah, I do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, if you would turn to page 24. As I say, they're virtually identical, so page 24 is the fee area that may be charged under both bills. And if you turn to line 23, the dash ones essentially say that a debt consolidation agency type, those that actually hold funds on behalf of the consumers, may take up to 15% of the funds that they receive each month, not to exceed $65. The dash twos take that last sentence out. The fee described in this paragraph may not exceed $65, so there's no such cap. Subsections D and E are identical, and the rest of the bills, I say, is identical. So Section C is the only change between the two amendments. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Representative Riley, I take a motion on the Dash 1 amendment.
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2191.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2191. Discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll just take this opportunity to register my no vote on all of this now and not bother you when we get to the bill itself. And I'm really troubled by this because your story, and I mean that your factual story about your constituent, is very compelling, and I'm concerned about that person, and I'm concerned about a lot of others in Oregon. I'm also concerned that we are not recognizing that there are a number of avenues for people who are in trouble. This is not the one that is this particular industry is not the one I would hope for anyone. But I believe that as awful as some of the programs that were described to us are, there are others that are honest, and it is the last stop before bankruptcy. And if they did participate in the program, they might have a chance of not losing everything and maybe coming back. So they provide, I think, an important service. They should be regulated. They should be looked into. And I would hope that that piece remains as one option. I would hope it's not the biggest piece, because there are lots of other things I hope people would do. This is not the time or the committee to go after the credit card come-ons that I think start a lot of this. I mean, one of the biggest problems that any of these folks face, and whether it's credit counselors or this industry, they're dealing with people who have used credit cards improperly. I wish we could get to that, particularly in this economy. I wish they wouldn't send them to my kids when they're in high school and college. But that being said, I think this is too far-reaching in the approach, and I can't support it, because I still think that this industry provides a service, those that are reputable, to folks who are on the brink. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments, of course, and of course I appreciate that you have your point of view on this. And I have no intention of putting reputable businesses out of business. I think we heard from many businesses who operate within this structure that this bill sets up, and quite frankly, even the debt settlement companies referred to models in other states that are similar to this that they operate in under as well. My concern is that there are many companies out there who advertise sometimes on late night TV and convince people that they can do things that they don't do. And so how you need to draw the line somewhere on what is ethical and what is a legitimate fee structure, I suppose, that doesn't end up preying on poor people, essentially, that are trying to get out of debt. And that's the scenario we've seen. We've seen this type of activity proliferating at a rapid rate. It's quadrupled in Oregon, the number of cases on this, and I think it behooves the state to try to put a line out there that says this is too far, and that's what I think this bill does. And I appreciate that you think it goes too far, but that's where
that's the motion.
That's the motion before us. So
certainly, and it's the cap. I got all wound up, and I neglected to say it's the cap that I particularly think is probably inappropriate for this. I agree with much of what you said, but that's the part I'm stuck on.
Yes, and I realize that, but without a cap, the fees can be extremely high, and high enough to drain someone's bank account to the point where they don't have any money saved up to pay any debt because it's all gone to fees. And that's what we've recognized in this case. So we're still under discussion.
On the dash amendments, right?
On the dash one. So I think not seeing any other discussion. I'm sensing I'll probably have some no votes on this, so I will, Cindy, have a roll call vote in reverse alphabetical order for this bill, please.
Representative Winger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative
Cowan? Aye. Representative Barton?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. The dash one amendments are adopted. Representative Riley?
Is there a subsequent on this?
I hate the cap.
Negative. Oh, excuse me. So we have a minimal fiscal on this, but we do have a Ways and Means referral that has been rescinded. So our motion will reflect that.
Sorry, the referral has been rescinded.
That's what you just said. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor of the DuPass recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Riley moves that House Bill 2191 as amended to the floor with the DuPass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Representative Wingard.
I don't want to take up too much of the committee's time, but I want to get a couple things on the record. First of all, I understand the chair's frustration with this service and the stories that people tell about their experience. I'm familiar with a few, and I am concerned about this industry. I still think it's a necessary service. I think I understand the business model and the service that they're providing folks who are in a very desperate situation in which they are really underwater against credit card companies. And I'm convinced that they're providing a service that no one else is, specifically what they're doing. I am concerned about the remedy we've sought. I share the desire to get at this in a regulatory way, but I'm not convinced that just coming in and setting caps or price controls on this is going to do what we want it to do, what I think the chair and I both want it to do. As I discussed a little bit with him privately last night, and I'll say out loud today, I think the answer may be more on the other end, on a strong refund policy, because you're dealing with a situation where people are putting away a good deal of money in an account, and then the company is making a claim that they'll save them some money on this debt settlement, and then there's sort of a bonus paid on that. I believe that the way to get here is with a strong refund policy, even stronger than the companies currently offer, and something that the department can enforce. I am still, though, concerned about our doing something. And as a result, even though I have serious concerns about this bill and how it attempts to remedy the situation, I will support it today.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate your comments. And I know that the other side of the building will, again, look at this issue and see if they agree with you. I have some reservations about, although I like the refund policy, I I think it's problematic for people that are generally poor and strapped for cash, that they're in this situation, that they get put into a position where they need a refund. And how long does that take, and what happens to them in the meantime when they can't feed their baby, or they have their wages garnished and they end up back looking to the state for assistance to live. I think it's, you know, it's a really a tough situation, but I appreciate your comments. So, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, I voted no on the amendments, and I have some concerns regarding the cap, the nature of our sort of our entering and controlling this market, and also the scope of that. I'm concerned we might be going in an overly broad fashion, where a scalpel might be more appropriate.
Well, thank you, Representative Barton. I appreciate your comments. I think we have authority over many parts of this industry, but not this one at all. It is completely unregulated by the federal government or by state governments or this state government. It is regulated in some other states where these problems have come up. And I think it's incumbent upon this state to attempt some regulation on this. And I think this is pretty consistent with the business models that we see generally in debt management and you know, for consumers and trying to keep their best interests in mind. At no time do I think consumers should be put in a position where they're spending a lot of money and they end up in worse financial shape than when they got involved with this kind of program. And that we've had repeated testimonies and cases that were documented by that last night. So I'm comfortable with the bill. Cindy, can we have a roll call vote in reverse alphabetical order again?
Representative Winger.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
No.
Representative Cowan.
Aye.
Representative Barton.
No.
Vice Chair Widener.
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2191, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And the chair will carry this bill. With that, I'll close work session on House Bill 2191. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3004. Victoria, will you please give us a brief summary of House Bill 3004? And I do believe we have some amendments before us, and I believe we have somebody in another committee room as well. Oh, no, we don't. He's here. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3004 provides that sale by trustee of foreclosed property or sale of residential property after judicial foreclosure precludes further action against mortgager for deficiencies in amount secured by mortgage. Effective on passage, you have dash 2 and dash 3 amendments in front of you.
Thank you. And first up, I have Jane Cummins. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jane Cummins. I'm the one who asked Representative Clem to introduce this bill because of a situation that my daughter and son-in-law found themselves in, as well as many other homeowners. I want to emphasize that the bill was intended to deal only with transactions that are part of the original financing package. There is nothing in the bill intended to preclude arrangements such as 80-20s. It's just that if there is a default, when there's several trust deeds and notes in the original purchase financing package, and the lender takes the property and sells it, they can't get anything more from the borrower. I believe that when ORS 867702 was written, it was written as part of some pro-lender legislation, but it was intended to protect the consumer. However, there is a loophole, and there was an Oregon case in the early 90s where on an appeal, one of the judges dissented strongly, saying that if you didn't interpret that section so that the borrower couldn't lose any more money, then it would be absurd and unreasonable, and it would render the statute meaningless. However, the other two disagreed and allowed it, and it is the loophole that we're trying to fix. In 2000, there was a federal court case that recognized this deficiency, and it was commented that you could use some crude. There was a loophole for shrewd creditors, and that the statute permits lenders to avoid the statute's constraints, that is, the consumer protection, simply by requiring the borrower to execute two notes and two trust deeds. And then on default, the lender forecloses one trust deed, recovers the home, precludes the borrower from redeeming the property, and then brings an action on the other note. And this would preclude this. I understand that there are several amendments, and though I, as you know, I'm not the expert on this, it seems to me that the dash threes are the ones that I needed to look at, and I don't believe that I have any problems with it.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee for Ms. Cummins? Thank you very much. I appreciate you bringing this issue forward. Mr. Carnes.
Thank you, Chairman Holvey and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Keith Carnes, and I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. Just as a very brief background, many states have enacted bills similar to what we have in the Oregon Revised Statute relating to an election of remedies. A lender gets to choose to either foreclose or to file a lawsuit to collect the money owed. They don't get to do both. This goes back to the Great Depression, when people were losing their homes and found themselves destitute. The states, including Oregon, decided to help people get back on their feet and keep them off the public welfare rolls. It was better to make the lender choose one or the other, but not both. The bill, as I read it now, undoes that in a significant number of cases. The original bill and the dash three amendments appears to only prohibit a deficiency when there's either the purchase price of the property is paid for out of the loan, or when there's a unity of ownership of the security interest. So if the same bank holds both loans and they foreclose, then they're precluded from bringing a deficiency action on whatever's left owing. Unfortunately, I think that this could be read that if I were to refinance my home and were to default, and I only had one loan on my home, the bank, which foreclosed, could then sue me for a deficiency. I believe that the Dash 3 amendments undo the current state of the law. It's my understanding that what we're trying to accomplish, and my hope is that what we're trying to accomplish, is to take the current state of the law and expand it into something else. I believe Representative Winger is the one who said that he got into his first home on an 80-20, and I did the same. The mortgage broker explained to me that Without the down payment, I wasn't able to qualify unless I did this 20% loan, and that would defeat private mortgage insurance, and that would save me money. And so that's what we did. And it's a good thing, and it's still happening in states that preclude what House Bill 3004 attempts to preclude. The concern is that most of these loans that are being done through mortgage brokers are being done with the intent of selling them off into securitized trusts. There's agreements where one lender will come in and pay for the loan. The loan will then be turned into a securitized trust, given to a trustee who will then distribute it and have it sold on Wall Street. To say who is it that holds a loan is a question that will give the attorneys for these lenders consternation for months at a time. I've actually been in litigation where I've asked five times who holds this loan, and they say, we don't know, and we're having a hard time finding out. Some of these are being held just in-house, but that's very rare, such as Washington Federal Bank is the only lender in Oregon that I'm aware of that actually holds loans in-house now. Most of these loans are actually just being serviced by the bank, who takes in the payment, takes out their portion, passes it on to one of four or five lenders like U.S. Bank or LaSalle Bank or Lehman Brothers, who failed, or people like that. And that money keeps going through the system into the people who own them, which may ultimately be us through our retirement plans. And so the question of deciding who owns the note is one that oftentimes cannot be answered. And so just trying to decide it based on unity of ownership is probably not one that could be answered, and really gives us no additional rights or remedies compared to what we have today. The way the bill was originally written, and I think is probably more in line with, well, it's certainly more in line with what's being done in California and in other states, is that if you have a purchase money security interest, meaning the money used to buy the property, it doesn't matter how many loans it's broken into, once one of them forecloses, all liens are now abolished and all rights to collect are abolished. Whereas if I later go out and borrow money against my property, then if the first mortgage forecloses, the second would then have the right to sue me if I defaulted on my line of credit. And so I believe that House Bill 3004 is moving us in the right direction, but still needs a great deal of work to ensure that we don't undo the protection that's being done today, whereas there's an election of remedy for any lender. They either foreclose or they take the home, but they either foreclose or they sue for the note. They never get to do both, and I think this bill actually allows some lenders to do both.
Thank you. So just practically speaking, and maybe in plainer terms, the idea of this bill was essentially to when a lender makes a loan for the purchase of a property, that and they provide a first trust deed and a second trust deed, and then they end up foreclosing on that property, that they would foreclose on one of those, and then they would sue on the note. The idea, this concept behind this bill was to disallow them to be able to sue on the note beyond what the value of the property was, I believe?
That's correct. They have the option, and we've seen some lenders decide that the home isn't worth going after, so they're just going to sue for what's owed. And so most of the time, they're certainly going to just foreclose, and this bill, as originally drafted, would, in the sense of where it was a purchase money or the money used to acquire the property, once they foreclose, they would be entitled to no more money from the person who borrowed or anyone else obligated on the note.
Okay. So I see we have another piece to this bill, and there's someone here to testify on it as well. And Representative Barton, you look like you want to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah,
but I'm not sure you know what it is.
Well, may I ask a few questions, please? Because I'm
certainly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carnes. Are you testifying in opposition only to the amendments, the -3, perhaps? But you are in favor of the underlying bill?
No, I'm opposed to the underlying bill as well, because as I read the underlying bill, a refinanced property, a bank who refinances an original loan on a home could also get a deficiency judgment against the borrower.
So you can understand my confusion, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carnes, of course, is famous for his pro-consumer, and indeed he's obviously knowledgeable. And this concerns me because this is clearly complicated, and the risk of unintended consequences with this bill, especially doing it at the last minute, is severe. So you're saying that Oregon currently already has an election of remedies law that derives from the Great Depression era. The problem that we are trying to fix, is that already covered in existing Oregon statute?
No.
Well, I'll let Ms. I agree, and I think that's what Ms. Cummins was testifying, is that judges have been pointing out this problem, that when lenders split their purchase money loans into two loans, they now have the option of foreclosing and suing, which seems to do an end run around ORS 86770. I think the fix just creates an additional problem that we didn't intend.
I see.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Riley.
So what you're saying is that you agree with what we're trying to do, but you disagree that we're actually doing it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we have asked for another amendment, and whether or not we get that amendment in time for this body is remains to be seen, but Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I very much agree with what I think we are intending to do with this bill. Again, there is clearly an acute risk of unintended consequences with this, and fortunately we have an expert like Mr. Carnes who can hopefully guide us through that, and I definitely do not want this bill to die because of time in this chamber, and I'm prepared to to follow your lead, Mr. Chair, but I would really appreciate it if whether it go to Rules or the Senate, that Mr. Carnes would continue to work this bill with great detail, if you'd be so kind.
I'll do my best. There's a lot of people who need my services and who pay me for them, but I'm happy to keep giving them for free to the legislature as long as I can be of help. And I'll
basically what we do, Mr. Carnes.
So yeah, I appreciate that. I appreciate that as well.
I appreciate that. There's another piece to this bill. I'm going to call up somebody else to testify on that piece of this bill that's actually somewhat unrelated to this specific issue, although it is related to trust deeds. And so I'm going to let him explain that for the committee because I think it's also an important piece of this bill. And it was originally the -1 amendments, which I believe were incorporated into the -3 amendments as well. And it's a pretty simple piece, I hope, I think. So anyway, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holdy, members of the committee. Chris Schultz representing Guerrilla Capital, and I believe we're discussing the -2 amendments. Sure, thanks so much. Guerrilla Capital is the largest purchaser of foreclosure homes in Western Oregon. They buy homes at foreclosure, they fix them up, and they quickly resell them to buyers of modest means.
Mr. Schultz, can you move the microphone a little bit closer to you?
Sorry about that.
You're kind of a soft
speaker. Keeps the homes from falling into disrepair and keeps neighborhoods vibrant. Guerrilla Capital is not typically involved in the legislative process, but it came to their attention that there were several bills moving on this foreclosure issue after the deadline to submit bills to legislative council. So this bill has a relating clause that is one of the only bills moving that's available for an amendment such as we're suggesting. Guerrilla Capital's suggestions relate to the process by which foreclosure homes are noticed and sold. And the best way to achieve the highest price for the lender and for the homeowner who gets any amounts beyond what is due on the note is to make sure there are as many bidders as possible on a home at the foreclosure auction. Guerrilla has two suggestions. Existing law requires that the trustee deliver the trustee deed to the purchaser within 10 days. That's not happening in some cases. The problem is not Oregon-based trustees. The problem is some of these folks in Southern California who are overwhelmed and haven't staffed up in a way to really respond in an adequate manner. The suggestion is that there be a civil penalty of $100 a day with a maximum of $5,000. Guerrilla Capital doesn't intend to collect that money. It's a hammer to get people to pay attention to them to get them to send them the deed. The second suggestion is when a bankruptcy filing stays a foreclosure auction. So you've got a process server essentially on the courthouse steps saying, hey, there's a bankruptcy here. We're staying this auction. That foreclosure just kind of goes dark. There's no additional notice about when that home comes back on the market. The second suggestion is that potential bidders be able to send a written notification to the trustee so they're notified when the home goes up again for auction. This will make sure that bidders are aware of the new auction date and that the highest price possible is achieved on the home. Oregonians will be helped by these changes, and it would help prevent foreclosed homes from going into disrepair. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions from the committee on this particular concept? Representative Barton.
I'm very sorry, Mr. Chair. I assure you, it hurts me more than it does you, hard as that may be to believe.
It is hard for me.
Yeah, indeed. I'm right there with you, Mr. Chair. This is essentially a first hearing on a totally new bill, Friday at 4:55, and the $100 a day concept. While I entirely trust Guerrilla Capital and their good intentions, this is going to affect a lot of people for a long time. Not all of them as well intentioned as Guerrilla Capital, and I'm just concerned about some unintended consequences.
What I'm hearing expressed is that the law requires them to turn over the deed within 10 days, and people that legitimately now own the property and can't get the deed or have their capital tied up without being able to do anything with it. And I think there's nothing in law that can compel them to get the deed back to them. And I think that's the goal of that $1,000 a day. It sounds kind of exorbitant, but there's certainly they're losing time of being able to utilize their property. But anyway, go ahead.
Hey, Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, if I can explain. So the Guerrilla Capital has handed over the money, but they don't have the deed for some number of days. And as you notice, attached to the letter are letters from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, the Department of Justice, and the Real Estate Agency. We've complained about this to the relevant state agencies, and they sent us letters referring us to each other. There's no remedy in state law to enforce the provision that the deed needs to be handed over within 10 days. We went through what appear to be all the options we have for complaining to Oregon state government agencies about this and got sent in circles. So this would give somebody who purchased a home at foreclosure auction a little bit of a hammer to try to get the deed.
Representative Burton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This sounds great when I hear these arguments. My concern, I suppose, is procedural. I know this is, or at least I'm told this is customary at this time of the session. At 4:55 on what is essentially an entirely new bill, I'm hearing one side of the argument from two people, and I just don't know what I don't know. I literally don't even know what questions to ask. This might have this might be a great bill, in which case it might be a bad bill. I feel just perhaps I object to the process. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not getting the information I need to make an informed decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a public hearing, and it is the process that it is.
Yes, it is.
And I'll give you the weekend to think about it.
Thank you.
So rest assured. I mean, yeah. And if you do have some concerns, I know we're trying to get a new amendment drafted by early Monday so that we can get the paperwork back hopefully on time to do something with this bill. It will be a very tight schedule. I appreciate the comments, and with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3004. And colleagues, I've been informed that
I have the votes to pass a particular bill that I closed a work session on, and so I'm going to reopen that work session.
Mr. Chair? Actually, we might no longer.
Oh, did we just lose one? Oh, never mind.
We're good.
Reopen the work session on House Bill 2383.
Oops, sorry.
And I believe we, on that bill, we were about to adopt an amendment. I'm trying to remember which one it was.
I don't know.
It was the Dash 1 amendment, I believe. No, it was the Dash 2 amendment. Dash 2 amendment. The House Bill 2383. Representative Riley.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2383.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2383. That was the 14-day rider refusal bill that gets implemented in 2012.
Oh, we're back in that file. I'm sorry.
So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Tomei.
As I recall, we had two witnesses who came up to testify that they supported this bill. Am I correct in that? Mr. Lanningham and...
No. I don't think you're correct. We had two witnesses come up, and Mr. Van Lanningham may come up and maybe clarify the support and non-support on this bill. That's why this bill got confused. So, anyway, Mr. Van Lanningham, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Lanningham, Legal Aid. Actually, I want to apologize. It's my fault. I want to apologize to the chair of the committee and to Representative Nathanson, and thank Representative Gilliam for pointing out my mistake. I expected Mr. Brenneman to say that that the landlords on this bill aren't happy but are willing to go along. Instead, he asked you not to move the bill. I want you to move the bill. When I testified before you on February 2nd, I essentially said, this is an important idea. It's just too complicated and contentious, and please direct us to come back in 2011 with a solution, in other words, the coalition. Both sides want the coalition to work on this issue and bring it back in 2011. The difference is that the landlords would rather not have a hammer to their head to make them negotiate. As a tenant advocate and as the facilitator of the coalition, I would say that it would help us to negotiate to have this pass. So I support the bill with the Dash 2, and I apologize again for failing to say that right the first time.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming back up and clarifying that. Now, I want to put you on the spot. I don't blame you for your point of view and wanting the bill to go forward. But if we didn't go forward, you did agree with Mr. Brenneman that you could have a good conversation and perhaps, I don't want to put words in your mouth, continue to work on it and maybe find a solution. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, that is correct. I believe the coalition will work this issue with or without this bill. I think, as I just said a minute ago, I believe that we would be more effective and more likely to reach a solution with the bill. The law doesn't work as it is now, and we need to fix it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Wingard.
John, I just want to go back to the testimony that you gave a little earlier that you and John both gave that I thought you were agreeing with, which was the sentiment that this coalition works because you work together and you provide a united front and that one gives and the other gives and that nothing moves that the two sides don't agree to. So I'm trying to square that with what's happening right now where you're asking for this bill to move forward and John had asked for just the opposite. And I guess when he articulated how contentious this used to be and that you have this, what I thought you both agreed was a great working relationship now that's been going on for nearly 20 years, I'm trying to square that with the desire to move this bill when one side of it has asked for that not to happen.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Wingard, to make one thing clear, Mr. Brenneman knows what I'm saying now. Because I told him that, thanks to Representative Gilliam, pointed out my error earlier and had to leave. So this is not secret to Representative Mr. Brenneman. The coalition is a fragile group. We almost blew up after the last session because of the park closure bill. I believe it helps us to have a deadline. And that's essentially what this bill does, is say that you must negotiate this, because otherwise this bill goes into effect after the 2011 session. Some landlords in the coalition would rather not have that deadline. As the facilitator of the coalition, I believe that it would help us to have the deadline. And this is the same concept that's been adopted in Senate Bill 929.
Sorry, I was sitting on it.
Mr. Van Lendingham, I apologize. I was sitting on my phone and it apparently dialed something. I am very sorry.
And put it on speaker. By the way, Representative Cowan, that's not the way the phone works, but an afternoon committee
I'm very embarrassed, but I am trying here.
Representative Cowan, I once did that chairing a committee in Eugene, and it was the police that I dialed. So,
look, 911 shows up, you'll know whose fault it is.
Okay.
I need a break.
Yeah.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. I believe I heard Mr. Behrman say to you that if you want the legislature to set your agenda for you, I think there's a way he put it, that was okay with him. Did I hear that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, in that I do most of the work, is saying that as long as I am willing to let the legislature set my agenda, then he's okay with that. And it is true that this issue has been one of my priorities for the last two sessions. We didn't get to it for good reasons. We had other things to work on. I would like to have you make us negotiate this and bring it back.
Thank you. Thank you, and I appreciate you coming forward again, and hope your health is good. And
after today, who knows?
Anyway, appreciate that. Representative Riley, the Dash 2 amendments
have been moved.
Have been moved. And have we voted on the Dash 2?
No, we have not.
Is there objection to the Dash 2 amendments? Representative Gilliam?
Yes.
Yes. We need a roll call vote. Cindy, can we have a roll call vote on the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2383?
Representative Winger?
No.
Representative Tomei?
Yes.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
No.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. The Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
We do have a pistol.
And, committee, we do have the paperwork. The fiscal is no expenditure impact. And no revenue impact. Representative Riley, I entertain a motion to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2383 to the floor with due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2383 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Winger.
Mr. Chair, getting back to my point again about how important I think it is for this coalition to keep working together. I think it's important for this bill to not move unanimously and then have some no votes on it, to make it clear to both parties that the legislature should not be the decider on these issues, and that as much as possible the two groups should work together, and that neither side should feel that they have a reason to feel comfortable falling back on the legislature to back their side up on these disputes. So for that reason, I'm going to make sure there's at least one no vote on this bill.
I don't think you'll be alone. And Representative Gilliam, I thought you already voiced your opinion on this. You want to talk again?
Oh, no.
I'd love it if you would, no. Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilliam, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no, but I respect Mr. Van Lanningham's point of view, and I want to encourage and send out, what is it, a shout-out to the coalition. because I've been through some other issues, and I appreciate the work. So this is not some sort of comment on the quality of your work or your ability to pull people together. So it would be my hope that you could. I completely understand your point of view on this, and if we, and with this speech, you're probably going to lose this bill. But if that's the case, I know you'll continue to work.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. I appreciate the comments, and I share your sentiments. I really do appreciate the coalition and all the work that they do, and especially Mr. Van Landingham, who I've put through some very trying days. But, I think it, as well as sending a message that we want the coalition to work together, this issue really needs to be dealt with. And I think that this bill does set a deadline for getting something done, and I think that's expressing our interest that the coalition come back and have a better solution to this problem than what's in this bill. And I think that it'll give them, some incentive to make that happen. And I'm hoping they do that together. And I'll try to facilitate them staying together if I can. I don't know if I'm the right guy for that, but I'll definitely make that overture to them. So I appreciate the comments. Cindy, could we have a roll call vote on the bill, please?
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Nope.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye. Yes.
Representative Wingard?
No.
Vice Chair Widener?
Excused.
Vice Chair Riley?
Because of Representative Gilliam's speech, I'm voting aye.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Holby.
The chair votes aye. House Bill 2383, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor.
Scared you, didn't I?
Representative Nathanson carry.
And we will have Representative Nathanson carry the bill.
Yes, indeed.
I'll close the work session on the House Bill 2383. Committee, I know people look like they're ready to bolt. I'm going to stand at ease just for a few minutes. I think we have just a little bit more work to do.
Okay. I know you do.
Let's
save it.
I'd like to reconvene the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
You want to move?
Second classroom, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, committee. Committee, we will be carrying over House Bill 2438, House Bill 2962, House Bill 3359, House Bill 2141, House Bill 3125, House Bill 3163, House Bill 2199, House Bill 3145, House Bill 3004, House Bill 2370, and House Bill 2784. Our next meeting will be Monday from 3 to 7.
You're done?
With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.